Okay, so you only get 15 minutes total.
Of course.
And so they are related, obviously, and so I would suggest, but that does give each of you a little bit of rebuttal time because you each have an appeal. So my suggestion, and you're from Gracemont?
Correct.
Okay. So what I would say, is there someone here by video too from Gracemont? It's only you.
Correct.
And are only you talking?
Correct, except for I only made an appearance in the one matter, so that's why the other co-counsel was supposed to come in for the other appeal. That's where the rub is.
Well, why isn't he here?
I can't speak to that, Your Honor. And I don't know if there, I'll have some. If you have some questions, I can maybe cursory answer them. But if you get
so, do we know why the other person isn't here? This Joseph Hong.
My understanding is he wanted to rest on the briefs on that part of the appeal.
Okay, so, so even though he's listed here, where did he say that? Well, maybe on he is, but maybe I don't have the. Let me see if I look at the latest one. Okay, I was looking at the one that's in my book, but let me make sure. Okay, so I think I only have her on this one. I had him on an earlier one. Okay, so did he talk to you about this?
I got an email about 2 days ago saying that we're just going to rest on the briefs on that part of the appeal. And I won't be appearing. And so just to be clear on the numbers, I made the appearance in number 20-17335.
Which one where you are the appellant? Or are you, what,
no,
are you appearing
one,
where you're the cross
correct,
appellant?
That's the one where Gracemont is the appellee, correct.
Well, then.
So that's why I was saying, I can, if I may.
Well, that's a little tricky because the appellant usually goes first.
Correct. So,
just
as an edification,
let's figure out.
Counsel for Bank of New York Mellon did email me, so we kind of coordinated. She said she was fine with me going first. She would go use all of her time, and I would have rebuttal. If we want to change it up today, I'm fine with that too. But we agreed.
All right.
I'm just letting you know that we had a discussion that if the court wanted to go with that.
Well,
that
it's up to the, it would be up to the court at this point. But that's why, but I know when all I have a cross appeal and an appeal.
Right.
But you only get, you don't get 15 minutes on each of them.
Understood.
So if I'm understanding, I mean, I would generally have, since we actually have you listed on both of the cases, or the person didn't, I mean, on the calendar today, we only have you appearing. I guess what I would suggest is, I think pursuant to, I mean, we know what this is about, and it all is intertwined. So if I were to understand, I know you're not at the podium right now, but for the bank, maybe you want to come up there just for a second so I have all this recorded, So I'll strong arm both of you into an agreement, and then neither of you can complain about this. But it's my understanding that you basically agreed that Gracemont would go first, but then you have some time to reserve for rebuttal, and then the Mellon's going to go. Is that right? But you know you have some time to reserve for rebuttal because you're representing. State your name too.
Yeah. Good morning, Your Honor. Natalie Winslow for Bank of New York Mellon.
Okay. So are you okay with that process then?
Yes, Your Honor. However the court wants to do it is fine with Bank of New York Mellon.
Okay. So we'll do it that way. And so then actually the bank's going to be the last one to talk. But if either of my colleagues have questions due to a little bit of the irregular process, I'll allow my colleagues wide berth on that as well. Okay. Okay, here we go.
Sorry for all the confusion.
No. I'm glad that you brought it up because I had a note to bring it up and I was just surging ahead, so I'm glad that you did. Go ahead.
May it please the court. Good morning. My name is Karen Hanks. I do represent Gracemont Avenue Trust. At this time, I'm going to reserve 7 minutes for rebuttal. As I indicated, I did appear on case number 20-17335. I'm more so prepared to address the court's question as to the application of Thunder Properties. Here, the district court's order can be affirmed, finding that the bank's complaint was time-barred. The court here did not use the sale. She used the
date of recording of the foreclosure. Well, I don't think it's quite that easy. I don't think it's quite that easy. We've all read Thunder Properties, and we've kind of come out of that. And Thunder Properties basically held that the HOA foreclosure sale standing alone is not sufficient to trigger the statute of limitations, which is what the district court did here. So I think it talks about what specific actions, if any, did Gracemont take after June 13th of 2012, the 2012 foreclosure against the bank.
And this is where I want to address. Thunder Properties, and one of the biggest criticisms of the dissent was it didn't give you the analysis of how you then would apply that holding, right? It literally just said the sale standing alone. Now, when we're talking about a statute of limitations, we have to read it in Thunder Properties in harmony with other case law of statute of limitations, and that is notice, right? Notice that the bank understands that its continued existence of its lien is in question. I mean, that's really what it boils down to.
Well, I think just for me, I can't speak for my colleagues because we haven't conferenced on this, but I'm just going to say for me, it looks like the district court erred in just saying that the HOA foreclosure sale triggered the statute. So I'm interested in, because it looks to me like Thunder Properties talks about notice of disturbed possession as being a requirement, and I'm interested to know what actions, if any, Gracemont took after that.
And sure, and I can talk about the actions after, but just for a point of clarification, the district court found it was the recordation of the foreclosure deed that triggered. And so that was a day later, and I understand that's still an action in terms of related to the sale, but she did not find the actual sale date. It was the recordation of the foreclosure deed. And the reason why that's important is you do see from the foreclosure deed recording that a third-party purchaser did purchase the property at the sale. So then what happens on the part of the Gracemont is what's your question? They didn't pay the lien. They're not obligated to pay the loan like the borrower, and they don't pay it the very first day that the very first month after the deed records in their name, they don't pay the loan. They don't pay it the month after. They don't pay it the next month after. There's also a statute in Nevada, NRS 107.200 and .210, that allows a successor in interest to request information about a loan that they would not otherwise be privy to because they're not the borrower. And one of the key information they can ask is the amount required to discharge the loan. Gracemont did not ask for that information. So what you have to look at also during this time period is that this particular bank was marred in litigation with countless purchasers at HOA foreclosure sales.
Okay, so if I'm hearing you, you're saying that you didn't do anything other than this, other than record, that you didn't do anything. So if Thunder Properties requires more, some notice of disturbed possession, you're saying the fact that you did nothing was your notice of disturbed possession? I'm not really quite understanding you here.
Well, because the holding is analogous to disturbed possession because they couldn't find that 107.080 or 070 where you have a title holder that actually needs to have their possession or title disturbed. They said something analogous. And this is what they said. They said some action like or such as repudiation or that is otherwise inconsistent with the lien's continued existence. That's what they said. There's an or. And that is an action inconsistent with the lien's continued existence because as the purchaser and not the borrower, you have no obligation to pay the lien or the loan underlying the lien.
So the difficulty that I'm having, I think it's similar to what Judge Callahan is getting at, is I could kind of, for instance, I could see how recording seems, you could argue it was inconsistent. The problem is you have this language in Thunder Properties that says mere notice of an adverse claim is not enough. It says that a couple times. And so it's almost like Thunder Properties is saying you have to go affirmatively do something. And it seems like the examples, other than the recording, which I suppose one could argue that, well, when you're recording, you're just basically recording. Nobody's disputing that you thought you had an interest. The question is whether or not you think your interest extinguished their interest, right? And so other than that affirmative act, everything you're relying on is not doing something, it seems like. And then it says, but if mere notice of an adverse claim is not enough, how can not be doing something be enough? That's what I'm struggling with.
Because it's in the sense of a particular person recording it, and then if they were obligated to do something with the loan, they would do these things. In other words, if they were recognizing your lien and the existence of it. I mean, here's the common definition of repudiation. The refusal to acknowledge.
The period is triggered when someone presses an adverse claim. You see what I'm saying? Not making payments doesn't seem to be pressing an adverse claim, to quote Thunder Properties. I'm not super clear, sure what to do with Thunder Properties. It seems like that's kind of why
that's
we have recording.
and that's the thing, Your Honor. I think that's where you have to come down to it. Where I think where I'm coming from it from a perspective of not looking at it just from after the sale. We have to look at the culmination of events. The claim was filed against both the HOA and Gracemont. In this case, it was filed against both of them. Quiet Title was filed against both of them. So we can't ignore, this is what my supplemental briefing addressed, we can't ignore the actions leading up to the sale. Recording of the notice of default, right? And Bank of America testified that in 2011, they knew, I'm accepting this is true for the sake of argument, that ACS wouldn't accept their payments. And yet they tried to pay, or they tried to get information and got rejected. That's an action that's happening that is inconsistent with your lien's continued existence. Then the sale happens. Then the property transfers to a third party. That deed gets recorded. That's an action. The party records the deed. Then you have, at that time, even prior to this sale in 2012, Bank of America had filed an action in federal court in 2011 against HOAs and collection companies saying, you're not recognizing that there's a super priority, you're not recognizing our right to pay it, and then they had a dispute as to what it comprised of. These are all things that culminate into the point of this sale, and then the recordation in Gracemont's name. Then even after that period of time, you have countless litigation with these purchasers, including Gracemont. So that's the action that's happening. It would be hard-pressed to
say. Well, let's just say all those actions that you're talking about that led up to the foreclosure, would you concede that none of those would trigger the statute?
I don't concede that, Your Honor, because you're filing a claim against the HOA in this case as well.
So you're saying, well, that just seems clearly inconsistent with Thunder.
I disagree, because Thunder Properties only said it has to be something more than the sale alone. They didn't go into the weeds of that particular case.
It didn't say that. It says mere notice of an adverse claim is not enough. If it said something, well, you just said, it would be easier, but it says mere notice of an adverse claim. You have to have someone press an adverse claim. That sounds very active, and you're saying they're really actively not doing anything, is what you're saying, it seems like to me, other than the recording of the deed.
Well, right. But then the other problem you have with that, Your Honor, is you have them denying the bank's argument that they don't have any statute of limitations. So essentially now we're in this conundrum. Are you saying they didn't say the purchaser had
say they have no statute of limitations.
No, I know.
Let's kind of pull everyone back from the extremes. It's sort of like Nevada to me is in la-la land over. I have no idea how the HOAs got something like this passed and that the whole thing. But that being said, they did. And we know but you also have the case where you lost on summary judgment, right?
No, not summary judgment, Your Honor. You're talking about the trial, the issue of futility.
Okay, but basically the district court found that there has been that there was no evidence that I think that the bank asserted that giving the money that actively, is it ACS or whatever, had actively been subverting all of this, and the district court said you didn't present any evidence to the contrary, and so you lost on that legal issue, right?
Correct, at trial. Yes, there was a trial.
So I guess let's just say hypothetically, I know hypotheticals are hard for people because I know that that doesn't mean you're conceding what your viewpoint is, but let's just say hypothetically that we don't think Gracemont has shown enough was done after, and that the statute had it did what has happened didn't trigger, and that there's nothing presented that could, and we say, okay, the bank is within the statute of limitations. Then based on this other finding, if you can't upset that, then the bank wins, right?
You mean even if you
The bank won on that. The bank won on the issue there. But they lost. It's kind of an odd posture, but they lost on the statute of limitations. So essentially, it just puts it, no one gets anything, right? It just leaves it where it is. But let's say, hypothetically, we think that the bank filed, it didn't blow the statute of limitations. If we find that here, then if we don't agree that you should, that no evidence was presented about, you know, these, the dealings of that they wouldn't give the amount, they wouldn't cooperate and give the amount that could be paid so that they could save it, then you lose, right? Then the bank wins.
If their claim goes forward, and yes, and you were able to, they were able to prove and you affirmed the trial court's order on the defense, yes, that would hypothetically be the result, yes. What's at play here, though, is you have the City of St. Paul versus Evans case that says you can't allow a party to use a defense, basically get around a time-barred claim and do a subterfuge and make their defense what their claim would have been.
Well, what I'm a little bit struggling with, and I'm just going to be candid with you because I think that it can be helpful to people, I'm not buying your that Gracemont did the plus here at this point. I haven't reached a final decision or whatever, but I'm struggling with do I decide that here or do I remand it to the district court to apply Thunder in the first instance here?
And I don't think that's a wrong decision, Your Honor. I've said that. I've filed other motions with this court remand. I believe that Thunder Properties only gave the holding and did not give the factual analysis.
Point that Judge Callahan just raised. Is there any genuine dispute of material fact here, or is it just a matter of legal interpretation of what all these facts mean in terms of whether the statute's been triggered?
It's a legal holding as to the statute of limitations is 4 years and the trigger date does require, it can't just be the sale. That's the holding. But where the factual analysis is what facts were happening, what actions were happening that were inconsistent with the lien's continued existence that would have triggered.
But is there a dispute about those facts, or is it just how we interpret those facts?
I think there's a dispute about the facts, partly because there's no record of the facts. I mean, they're in the supplemental briefing, but below, the court categorically just found the claim was time barred based on the recordation of the foreclosure deed. There was no analysis as to the trigger date. Everyone was operating at that time as if that would be at least the sale itself would be the trigger date. Here, the court took the recordation of the deed. So I think there is a further factual analysis, as I've highlighted in my supplemental brief. In other words, where was Bank of New York Mellon's notice? Did they honestly sit with this case and during that time period, 2012, 2013, and tell themselves, we don't think our lien is not continually existing? They had notice. There's other actions happening outside of Gracemont.
Yeah, but they'll probably concede they had notice, but it wasn't notice of a disturbed possession. I mean, the Thunder Properties Clear says you got to have more than just notice of an adverse claim.
But the point is the actions that are challenging. It says, or actions that are inconsistent with your lien's continued existence, those actions of contesting liens, fighting those liens, having to file a lawsuit with the federal court to get collection companies to acknowledge the super prior, these are all actions that are inconsistent with the lien's continued existence. After all, why did they file the claim? They filed it in 2017. I'd want to know, why did you file your claim? You were on notice of something. What changed in that time period? What happened between 2012 and 2017? Nothing, in the sense of nothing different than I'm talking about.
Your theory of why they waited until 2017, because that's when the economy got better and suddenly the properties are worth doing that? Why do you think they waited until 2017?
The quiet title? Well, this is the quiet title action, so it didn't matter that the market was getting better. They still had to go into court.
No, I know, but in theory, they should have, I think you're saying, you know, if they really... They could have filed it years earlier. They could have filed this thing years earlier. Why do you think they waited till 2017?
I don't know. I don't know why they waited too long. I don't know. All I'm saying is they waited too long. And there's nothing, no factual actions that were happening during that time period are any different. All the facts and actions that I'm talking about all existed during that time period. So what would be the basis to be able to say I can wait until 2017 to file the action?
Maybe Ms. Winslow will tell us why they sat.
Okay, we've basically taken up all your time, but I'll give you 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Good morning, Your Honors. Natalie Winslow again for Bank of New York Mellon.
Well, we've kind of centered the issues for you, so that should help out. So basically, it sounds like Gracemont saying the recordation of the foreclosure sale. Why isn't that sufficient to be a notice of disturbed possession under Thunder Properties?
Yes, Your Honor. And Ms. Hank's position really is the events that happened pre-foreclosure sale gave some sort of notice of disturbed possession to
Bank. Well, she says that, but she also says that the recording of the deed is something that they did after that should satisfy disturbed possession, I think. I think I heard that.
The reason why that can't be sufficient under Thunder Properties is because, as the majority discusses in Thunder Properties, not all super priority lien foreclosure, I'm sorry, not all HOA foreclosure sales are on a super priority lien. The bank can pay the super priority lien pre-sale, they can tender. Excusive tender can happen. In other words, just simply because there was a foreclosure sale and there was a foreclosure deed recorded does not press an adverse claim. And that's particularly true when you look at the facts of this specific case, because in this specific case...
did you get any communications from Gracemont between June 13th, 2012 and January 16th? 2013?
No, Your Honor. There were no communications. The first communication that Bank of New York Mellon had with Gracemont occurred when Bank of New York Mellon filed its lawsuit in January 2017, and then Gracemont appeared and filed counterclaims against Bank of New York Mellon.
Tell me, why did Mellon wait 4.5 years after the recording of the sale to do anything?
That's the burning question. The answer to that is from a very practical perspective, is in 2017, all of these banks were starting to their own foreclosure process. And no bank, and actually no purchaser in an HOA foreclosure sale either, no one could get title insurance post-foreclosure sale. So as the bank was contemplating moving forward with foreclosure, it wanted to get make sure that the property would be able to be insured. Title companies were not insuring.
But, you know, I mean, the bank hadn't been paid for ever since 2012 or July of 2012. So why in the world did it sit around for years?
Your Honor, I don't know the answer to that question. It's not in the record. But I will say that Nevada has a very rigorous foreclosure mediation process. So in a lot of instances, banks are hesitant to move forward until it makes sure that all of those statutory requirements are met. If I could turn back to...
Can I ask you, who has possession of the house right now? Like who actually has possession of it? Is it the Gracemont?
Gracemont has possession. Bank of New York Mellon has not yet foreclosed.
Is that the norm in these cases? Is that the person that came in and purchased it at the foreclosure sale has possession until the bank's title clearance proceedings are sort of finished?
That's correct. And that was actually one of the big...
How does that not kind of put you on notice?
Well, because the reason why it doesn't put you on notice is because what was contemplated when all of these HOA foreclosures began in 2011, 2012, was that these purchasers would come in, purchase the properties at the HOA foreclosure sales, and then sit back and wait for the deed of trust beneficiary to foreclose. In fact, you can see in this case...
That's fine, but they're not sitting back and waiting. They're rolling in, taking possession, and I assume renting these properties out to people.
Yeah, it was their property to do that. They can do whatever they want with the property until there is a deed of trust foreclosure.
But they're not paying, and that goes to her point that they're. But if that was sort of the understanding, they're not. You'd hope they're making the payments to you if you have the priority, if you have priority as a lender.
Yeah, that would be the best case scenario for Bank of New York Mellon, but certainly the purchaser wasn't obligated to pay on the loan. They weren't a party to the contract. They could simply sit back, collect rents, and wait for Bank of New York Mellon to foreclose. And that really is the draw
and
for...
And get their... I mean, a lot of these, if I recall, they foreclosed for some fairly low amount, so if they have possession for a few years, they get, I don't know, however much a month for 2 years, it's enough to actually get their interest out of it. And they, okay, so I guess I could see where that might be something that everybody understood.
And Your Honor, if you look at the actual record in this case with the communications between the HOA trustee, ACS, and Miles Bauer, the law firm for Bank of America here, you can see that that was really what the HOA trustee and Miles Bauer understood was happening because, and this is at Excerpt of Record 425, is the letter from ACS to Miles Bauer after Miles Bauer is attempting to find out the super priority lien amount to tender that. And what ACS says to Miles Bauer is ACS recognizes the bank's interest as being the senior mortgage holder. So there was no, unlike what Ms. Hank says, there was no confusion pre-foreclosure sale between the parties that the bank had the senior interest. And ACS goes on in that letter, and actually paragraphs 1 and 2, and talks about how it was not going to provide to Miles Bauer the super priority lien amount of 9 months of assessments because from ACS's perspective, the super priority lien amount, the super priority lien did not come into existence until after the deed of trust foreclosure. Now, that was what we found out to be in the SFR investments decision in 2014, an incorrect position because the super priority lien exists at the time the notice of lien is recorded. But it does illustrate that the parties here understood that there was no dispute.
Well, I want to kind of go out these hypotheticals, just if you put yourself it, you don't have to, I recognize the hypothetical doesn't concede anything. But let's say that, and I'm not speaking with any knowledge of what the panel, we don't have a conclusion. We don't conference till after we hear oral argument. But let's say hypothetically we would agree that the district court was wrong about under Thunder Properties, about that the statute of limitations had not run. All right. Is that something we can decide here, or is it something that we need to remand to the district court to apply Thunder Properties in the first instance?
I think that this panel could decide that the court erred in finding that the statute of limitations ran. I think the appropriate procedural mechanism at that point would be for the court to remand for the district court to determine the trigger, if any, for the statute of limitations.
Why? Do you think there's disputed facts, or is it just a legal interpretation?
There are no disputed facts. It is a legal interpretation, but I think that because the district court did not have the benefit of Thunder Properties and did not apply Thunder Properties, it would be appropriate for the district court.
Why? I mean, if it's just a legal interpretation, isn't it judicially inefficient to send it back to the district court to interpret, and then whichever of you loses, come back here a second time? We can decide the law supposedly even better than the district court.
I do think it is judicially inefficient to do it that way. I just think procedurally that, to me, makes the most sense.
Why does it make the most sense if it's inefficient?
So then we can see all you again?
You just want to come back and see
us? That we really like you? Yeah, we really like you.
Well, and let me add to that. It's a little surprising. I could totally see, since your adversaries have possession of the house, but, I mean, that's going to burn up another year and a half. And you won't have the house that whole time, right? The bank won't have the house. So if you were going to prevail, so I'm a little surprised that you would have that position.
Well, Your Honor, there's nothing stopping the bank from right now going out and foreclosing. There is no injunction in place, and as the district court held with respect to the trust's counterclaim, the deed of trust survived the foreclosure sale.
I would think if I were in your position, and I'm not, so I don't have all that, but that I would say, oh,
you three can decide that, and you can say that that it was filed within the statute of limitations, and that the then the other claim that has to do with ACS that you prevailed on, that we could affirm that, and then we could send it back to the district court to order judgment in favor of the bank.
Yes, Your Honor, I do think that that.
Well, that's what I would think you would be arguing.
Yes,
I would never, you know, I don't want to put, you know, and I'm not putting words in what we would do, but I think we have that option if we felt that there were no disputed facts, that there would be nothing more that Gracemont, that we know everything that the district court would know, and that if we agreed that the district court erred in ruling against you on the statute of limitations, that we could do that. But then we have to separately look at where you prevailed on the claim regarding whether ACS, whether there's any factual disputes on that.
Yes, Your Honor, and it is, as you said, with Ms. Hank's argument, we are in an odd procedural posture because the counterclaim, which was the mirror image of the bank's claim, actually went forward to a trial on the merits, and the district court made specific findings that...
So we're reviewing that for on what basis?
Whether there was clear error. So from the bank's position, there was no clear error. In fact...
So you are going to say you should win on that? I mean, I don't want you to give away the...
Right,
we should... I mean, you shouldn't give away the entire courthouse.
Right.
If you're, I mean, that
right.
would seem odd.
Right. The substantive claim that went forward on at trial, that should be affirmed because there was no clear error that the district court made. And in fact, both in the trial, at the trial, and in the briefing on appeal, the trust makes really one argument for why there was clear error. And that is that no representative from the HOA trustee testified, and therefore the bank could not show that there was a known policy of rejection.
Well, I want to make clear to both of you. I mean, obviously, we listen to what both of you say, and we take you through hypotheticals, and we don't, whether you, we don't, I think anyone that argues before a court knows that courts don't always do what the parties ask us to do. I mean, we will make our independent determination, but it was surprising to me that you were conceding that we didn't have the authority to decide.
I'm not conceding that this court does not have the authority to decide that. No, Your Honor, I was just saying that maybe the more appropriate mechanism would be to put it down to the district court to decide it, but I do think this court could decide it as well, too.
Can I? So... It doesn't sound to me like either side is saying to Judge Gilman's questions about whether there's a disputed issue of material fact. Nobody's saying there's any disputed issues of material fact. As I heard your opposing colleague say, it was more just that these facts sort of really weren't gotten to by the district court and so sort of came out in the supplemental briefing. But if they're not disputed, I'm trying to figure out, is that a, you know, can we, if they're not disputed issues, you know, they're going to be saying facts before the district court, and we're just applying a lot of those undisputed facts. I'm trying to figure out if that's any sort of bar, either hard bar or maybe a prudential bar of us not reaching it. That's the only thing I could think that would. What is your view of your opposing counsel's argument that, you shouldn't reach it because the district court never reached these at all? Not that they're disputed, but that the district court never reached these issues at all.
The district court did consider when the statute of limitations was triggered. In fact,
it was conclusionary.
It stopped that foreclosure early.
End of story. You lose.
And so it never got to these facts that are, because it stopped at a certain point. It never, I mean, your point of counsel's argument, as I understand, is it didn't really consider or address or discuss any of these facts beyond that. Well, I guess should we just not worry about it because you both agree as to what the facts are? I mean, seriously, like, I guess in district court you would both agree too, and those would be the facts.
Well, the only date proposed set forth by the trust down below for what triggered the statute of limitations was the HOA foreclosure sale.
Yeah, but I mean, and we could say that they'd waived any other argument except for a new law came out, and so presumably they should have a chance to address that new law, right?
Well, I think that Thunder Properties confirmed what the statute of limitations was, but the statute of limitations has always been what the statute of limitations is. And it was hotly contested before Thunder Properties came out earlier this year. Two things. One, whether there was a statute of limitations, and two, what triggered the statute of limitations. And obviously that was the case because that was certified to the Nevada Supreme Court to decide because...
Well, did they argue down below all the facts that were... I think that counsel for Gracemont was saying here that they're arguing what happened before the foreclosure those are important facts. Were those facts all part before the district court?
The facts were before the district court, yes, Your Honor. It was all part of the summary judgment briefing. The trust did not argue that those facts gave rise to any sort of statute of limitations trigger date other than the HOA foreclosure deed recording.
Okay. And my colleagues don't appear to have additional questions, but I'll give you 2 minutes for rebuttal, too, so we'll kind of do that.
Your Honor, just picking up on your last question, not all the facts that I have argued in the supplemental brief were before the district court, namely the lawsuit filed by Bank of America in 2011.
But if they're not going to be, to my question, if they're not going to be disputed, you know, if you don't have a disagreement about it, they are before us, they're the same facts that were before them. So to Judge Gilman's question, why couldn't we just... you know, cut out the middleman, so to speak.
You could. What I was going towards was there might be even more facts, and that's where remand might be appropriate, and that's where I brought
that's
up...
That's where that would be, unless they're disputed, that would be frustrating for us, because that's kind of why we ordered the supplemental briefing, I think, not to speak for my colleagues, but, like, that's what we wanted to know.
Right, but unfortunately, one of the facts that I think would be important to know is, why did you file your lawsuit in 2017? What notice did you not have before that point that somehow changed? If you're saying Gracemont didn't give you any notice, what happened in 2017? So I'm just saying that's a possible element. I'm just speaking hypothetically, Your Honor. Do I think you have enough facts to decide that the district court can be affirmed? Yes, but there may be additional facts. I do want to clarify one point, though, in terms of the holding. Your Honor, when you're talking about pressing an adverse claim, that is not what the Supreme Court said with this. That discussion happens at I don't have the pin site. It's at the headnote 23. They're actually talking about what is required when you are pressing an adverse claim against someone who is a title holder or possesses the property. The holding, though, they're doing it just in terms of analogy. That is not the holding for a context of this case. The holding is there has to be some action that repudiates the lien or is inconsistent with the lien's continued existence. And that's why our argument is it's a culmination of these events that lead up to the recordation of the foreclosure deed. It's a recording of the foreclosure deed to a third party. And it's that third party, I mean, if we take the basic definition of repudiation, they are refusing to acknowledge your lien. They're taking possession. They're doing things with the property. They're paying the taxes. They're paying the HOA dues. And what aren't they paying? They're not paying the bank's debt because they don't believe the lien exists. It's extinguished. And that's also further proven by the fact that the same purchaser is litigating in other actions and disputing it. It's a consistent position.
We're out of time, but maybe just Calhoun would be nice. Couldn't it also just be, you know, if I was in your shoes or your client's shoes, couldn't it also just be, you know what, if we behave ourselves and pay the taxes and do all this stuff, they'll just let us hold on to it for 3 years, and we only paid, I don't know how much for this one, but we only paid 10 grand for this property, and we'll make a nice... You know, we're going to, with 3 years of rental income, we'll pull out 30, say. And so why wouldn't, in other words, it's not clear to me that those actions don't necessarily, why do those actions necessarily indicate that they were adverse? Why couldn't somebody, a rational economic actor, sit there and say, I'm going to take all these actions to be a really good property holder until the bank finally decides to act, and I think I'll be able to make some money off of just doing that?
Because the only requirement that Thunder Property said was actions that are inconsistent, and that is an action inconsistent. The fact that you aren't requesting the information to discharge the debt, that's inconsistent. That's all that the court said. And these are, we can just look at the common definitions of those words. The common definition of repudiate is refusing to acknowledge. Those are actions that do those very things. And while I understand someone might be able to look at it that way, the bottom line is you as a lien holder are, you have to take, this is notice to you. That's all this is about. Notice that you potentially have a question as to whether your lien persisted after this sale. And I'm frankly...
Now, there you got your problem, because under property says clearly got to be more than notice of adverse claim. It's got to be something that shows disturbed possession. That's the something more that I understand is the issue before us.
But is that, but they couldn't, they didn't say that in the sense that they said it had to just be analogous. And then what they said was such as repudiation or actions inconsistent with the lien's continued existence. That's what they said was analogous, because
all right,
they couldn't.
I think we've squared up where we are, what we think are the issues here. So I appreciate both of you in terms of the argument that you presented to the court. And this matter will be submitted. Thank you both for your argument.